Welcome to the penultimate episode of Wise Up, the show that aims to break down barriers in the music industry by pairing upcoming young music executives with industry vets. None other than prayers in the morning, and I don't know if I'm just scared or I want to be prepared, so I seek the man upstairs for precaution, or if I really want to change the way I'm walking. That's metaphorical. In this episode, I'll be talking to Tertia Willis and Jonathan Imieri about merch. Tertia is the co-founder of Terrible, a merchandising company that more resembles a movement, and has worked with artists like Heady One and PJ Harvey. Jonathan also runs his own creative merchandising brand called Crafty Creations, and he started out at Small Green Shoots. But we'll be diving into the ins and outs of merch and what a business on that side looks like shortly. Problem with the way that I step, I got away with finesse, and the ladies say they love the way I got the game unlocked, and there's less harder working niggas than the days that I rest. Don't let that go over. So to kick off, probably my most burning question to you, Tertia, which is something you probably get a lot, but how did you come up with the name Terrible and why?
Well, when we started out, all music merchandise was really, really bad. So we playfully called it Terrible Merch. We've abbreviated it since, is how we started, because that was where the bar was. And we actually set out to make more high quality merchandise than everyone else. But we thought we'd just come out the gate saying what it was.
I like it, calling it out as it is. Mm-hmm. And that kind of spawned from something called the Terrible Movement, which was preceding the merch.
It was. We had an apparel brand that was sustainable long before its time, before it was cool. And we sold into Urban Outfitters. We had a mini moment of fame where before influencers were known as influencers, they were all wearing our stuff. We had like Cara Delevingne wearing it on when she won Model of the Year, and she was on the cover of the New York Times and 8 other publications. And then my co-founder Jack signed to a major label and needed some merchandise, so that's where we started. It kind of grew out of that, and eventually we closed down the apparel brand and just started doing music merchandise because the demand was so big.
Oh, that's awesome. And was Jack, and like, he was an artist that signed to...
He was a drummer. I don't think he's played drums in a few years now. I think it's all just been merchandise, but yeah, he was a drummer. I got signed to Sony, one of the labels under there, and actually left 18 months or so later to come work for us because things got real busy, and yeah, he walked away from that deal into the merch business.
I'm sure there's an interesting story there.
Yeah.
And Jonathan, like, what kind of attracted you towards like music and merchandise? And you kind of started out with some graphic design, right, for Small Green Shoots.
Right, yeah, so I started off doing an apprenticeship in graphic design and content production at Small Green Shoots. Small Green Shoots really helps young people to get into like the music industry, or just the creative industry in general. And I came across an advertisement online to join as an apprentice. So I learned all my graphic design and really just my knowledge of like content creation in general. Small Green Shoots, and from there I wanted to kind of progress almost in my own way as well, taking on kind of like freelance graphic design work for the most part. That was whether that's, you know, cover art or, you know, digital banners or things of that nature. And then from there I was actually given a task of creating merch for an artist, and been assigned that way, and that caught a lot of traction at the time. And so from then I kind of delved more into it and started creating more clothing from there.
Oh, that's awesome. Like, can you tell us who the artist was?
So it's a local artist, it goes by the name of Mills, I think a North London rapper, and from that a lot of people was asking about, you know, who designed it, who made it, and then all roads led back to me. We started to get people asking for more things, and that's kind of where the ball slowly started to roll.
Did you, Tertia, did you find like a kind of similar like domino effect when you had, like, I guess Jack was your first artist that you made merch
for? Yeah, so It's kind of cheating, isn't it? Yeah. So, I mean, we made it for him. We didn't expect it to be a business. It wasn't our business. But we did it, you know, the way we did it and the way we approached it from almost a fashion perspective where things were manufactured to a high standard and it was different to what was out there. And that is what caught everyone's attention. And it snowballed from there. I think the one amazing thing about the music industry, when you do good work, it travels fast. So I feel like that's something we can all, that's like the one lucky thing about being in the music industry.
Definitely.
It's a small industry and the word definitely spreads, especially, as you say, like when you're doing good work and people take notice. And like one thing that struck me about Terrible is quite a strong focus on sustainability and like making things aligned with the climate. And, you know, I mean, that's not something everyone, it's slowly coming into fashion. It shouldn't have to be a fashion thing, but it's cool to see you guys kind of take the reins on that very early on.
The fans demand it, to be honest. The fans, you know, of the artists demand it. So the artists have to deliver on that. I think we get emails every time there's a new product launch. If we don't say the sustainability or where it's from or how it's made, people are asking those questions because they won't buy unless it like meets their standards. So it's, you know, you've got to deliver. Not only is it good for the planet, we should be doing it, but also fans are happy to pay a little more to get a better product and not like have people working for less than a living wage or have, you know, slave labor or child labor in the supply chain or, you know, even just something being shipped halfway across the world 4 times. People really want to know where this stuff came from, how it's made, and make sure that they're not giving money to an evil cause that's killing us all.
That's really cool to hear. I didn't know that. Like, yeah, I suppose like there is a lot more awareness nowadays and people have an idea of what their standards are in terms of environmental sustainability. But I always assumed it was, yeah, it was the company first and people kind of followed.
We did start sustainable. It's just, the, you know, fans are now demanding it. So that is, you know, that's the go-to. It's always about what's resonating with actual audiences. I think that's universal everywhere. It's something that you can never really predict, but doing the right thing shouldn't ever go out of fashion. So
I suppose you can take pride in wearing a product as well, knowing that it is sustainable. You know, it gives you a better feeling when wearing a product, I think.
I think so too, yeah. Absolutely. And they last longer. They're better made.
Yeah,
100%. Jonathan, like, is that something you've kept in mind as well with Crafty Creations?
Yeah, definitely. I think that in terms of a product, like Tasha mentioned, with the quality of product, the sustainable aspect is something that you know that it will have long-term wear. You don't really want to have a product that down the line isn't so wearable, as not only is it good for the environment, but also, I suppose, the brand's reputation. Just knowing that something that can be lasted, maybe even handed down, or, you know, is something that is a piece that can be looked at with appreciation. I think that's definitely important with anything, really, but especially with clothing, as it's a part of a person's personality. You know, what you wear is what you stand for.
Yeah, that resonates.
And I think also if you're in North London, Jonathan, you're having to compete with a lot of streetwear, so you've got to be like up there with everyone else, like that, the other things that people could buy. So it needs to be as good as those are.
Exactly. That is true. I think in a way it's almost like, you know, when you hear the analogy, like when you buy a car, you might not notice as many cars until once you got that certain car, you notice more of those cars. So what you said, it's so true. Once you do like delve into like the streetwear and fashion, side of the industry, you do notice, and I think we just help each other out. You kind of take bits and pieces of information from one another, and that is definitely, the sustainability is something that it could be thought of in every company, I feel.
Yeah.
I feel like we could chat sustainability for the whole podcast, but I'm going to bring it back to like kind of maybe before the Terrible Movement. And like, were there other points where you were freelancing as well, Tasha? And like, how did you kind of make the transition into like a solid business?
So I had many jobs. I worked some serious jobs. I worked in private equity.
Oh, wow.
And I also worked in fashion. And then I went part-time. And at the very last thing I did as a freelance thing. I helped another friend kind of organize and arrange their street food startup, like doing all the kind of admin and getting things together on that, just almost running it behind the scenes for them, not with any of the talent they had for food, but doing all the other stuff. So there was a brief moment in my life where I freelanced, but I was working full time, very well paid, then very not so well paid because in fact it's fashion. And then eventually freelance with, yeah, like a 3-day week I was doing freelance, and I was working on other things alongside that. So it wasn't an obvious instant transition. It was, it happened over a long period of time till eventually I just didn't want to work for other people anymore. And I made the leap. I felt like if I didn't do it then, I wouldn't know, you know, I wouldn't ever know if it would really work or not. And the worst that could happen was that I'd have to go back and work for other people again.
A lot of people find that when they have like this kind of side hustle going on, and they have, or maybe not side hustle, but like, you know, you've got a business that you're developing in parallel, and they might have a day job, and it can be tricky to find the right moment to be like, okay, this is it. This is my chance to go full time. I want to kind of do my own thing and see where that goes. Like, was there a particular moment that made you or helped you decide?
Being fed up of working for other people was kind of the moment, I think.
Yeah.
Eventually comes to a point where you're just like, I should be doing this myself. Like, I'm doing this great work for someone else. And it's a bit of a roll of the dice. And, you know, the first month or two, you're absolutely terrified. You're not going to make rent. So you start learning about how to sell things really well. and you take the leap. It's a terrifying moment, but you'll never take yourself seriously, and you'll never show your true potential unless you like go all in. And I think for me, the best thing was being absolutely terrified that I couldn't pay my rent. And that really got me motivated to get selling, which, you know, and get working on the business properly, making sure I was getting enough sales in so I could at least like cover the basic living costs. It's a scary moment. And I think even to this day, you know, we employ people, we look after people. I'm always concerned with sales and keeping the business afloat, make sure everyone gets paid. There are moments where it's terrifying. It's, you know, like it's running a business is always frightening, but the beginning leap is probably the hardest one, but those feelings remain the entire time.
Mm.
It shows bravery, I think, as well. Just being able to want to take that leap, especially like you said, you almost like push to your limit, isn't it, to make ends meet. And then with the resilience, that's when you see the true results. And I think knowing that, you know, you're at your almost pushed to your edge. When you see when you reap the benefits of that hard work, it's even a better feeling, isn't it? So that's inspiring.
I think definitely brave, definitely like courageous. And like you never know how far you'll get if you it's really simple, but if you don't actually try and kind of put yourself out there. And that pressure, oh my god, that pressure of like making rent every month, like what better motivates it, really?
Yeah, I mean for me especially, I didn't grow up in the UK, I don't have any family here, so you know, it's like do or die time, you know.
And I
do think that most people who kind of go down the entrepreneurial path, it's really common that you don't have anything to fall back on. This dream you have is actually a bit of a necessity. So I think, yeah, that you've got to have a bit of bravery, but also there's that feeling of what's the worst that could happen.
Do you feel like, sorry, I don't know if she's gonna ask this, AJ.
No, go for it.
But because you mentioned your time her working kind of like the admin side in a street food company, almost like running the business, do you think that helps you with your time when you decided to go on your own venture, or not really?
I mean, every experience has contributed to where I am now. Like, there's no question about it. I think seeing actually that I was capable of it helped me, that I was capable of it even before doing the job. So I could have done it myself, but it's almost like a confirmation that it was possible. And also, like, those guys were so disorganized. I was like, if they can get this far, why can't I? You know, and it's always nice to be inspired by people around you, even if it's in a bit of a competitive way.
Definitely.
How would you, like, what advice would you give someone to mentally prepare themselves for making that jump?
Oh, okay. I mean, the things that really helped me much later, that I wish, the tools that I wish that I had before I made that leap, was being very good at Excel spreadsheets. You know, you can get very good from YouTube. So, you know, having that skill right away so you can understand what's coming in, what's going out, that your margins are working. The other thing, about a year or so into working on Terrible, I got recommended a book called Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday. And I've just finished reading it for the 9th time. I would recommend that book as a thing to read, and another one with it, Obstacles the Way, which will, you know, teach you that, you know, you're not entitled to everything. You have to work for all of it, and you should be happy and overjoyed by it. And I think those things have really helped me. There's something about stoicism that keeps you humble and focused and realistic, but also, you know, very aware of what you're capable of and what you're not, and where you need to ask for help. And, you know, that it's going to be hard and you don't deserve it easier. I think those are having that feeling that it's meant to be hard and you're meant to be challenged, and knowing that's what's ahead would have made that jump a little less kind of frightening in a way, because you would know that you're walking into like the hardest thing you're ever going to do. And it's every day I wake up and it's still the hardest thing I'm ever going to do. But if I had those two books before I started, I think I would have come in and gotten a lot further, because I wouldn't have been caught up in like, why isn't this coming through? Why isn't this happening? Because I think I spent a lot of time questioning my judgment. It's all education, like it's all an education in running a business. But I had almost like a kind of like a childlike being like, this is so unfair, and that's not the truth of the world, and I had to learn it the hard way. So I would recommend those two books, and you know, they just kind of set you up for like the punches you inevitably are gonna, you know, that are gonna land with you in the business of music or merchandise or any creative industries, especially. I think any business, but especially the creative industries.
Thank you for sharing that. Like, stoicism is something I've really try and kind of learn more about. And I've read both of those books and they're phenomenal. So if you're listening and you haven't had a chance to read them yet, I really recommend them.
Ninth time this year.
Fucking impressive.
Every time I need a new reminder about something, you know, you find yourself getting a little whiny about something or feeling a little hard done by the world, and you just realize that great things do not happen with anything other than like hard work and persistence. And the stories in those books really do show that, you know, in a way that is relatable and useful for life.
I was just going to ask, because you said that, you know, on your journey, like, punches are inevitable. I mean, I suppose it's sort of a case-by-case basis, but is there, like, for example, an example of something that you can give maybe that early on that you faced that you know, and maybe how to combat it?
Oh yeah. Oh my God. I've got many. I've got some from this week, but very early on, like I took a startup loan. That's how I kind of got the money to do this next thing. I took the maximum I could get, and I made it last me like the full year, which is mental. It's wild, because it wasn't enough to live on. It wasn't enough to like even cover the cost of the production of the things we were doing. But you know, I made it into more money. And then after that ran out, we stumbled across a really big problem in merchandise that we couldn't take on enough clients as just the two of us that we could manage and still make money. And we saw this, you know, and I have like the people we are working for, artists, essentially make money, you know, paying them fairly for their products that they're putting their brands on, you know, helping them actually get money out of it, because that was our intention with it. And we went out to go fundraise, and it took me 2 years to raise a very small amount of money. Any investor I spoke to, number one, like, you know, dealing as an underrepresented founder, in a sense, as a woman, I was dealing with a lot of stuff that I shouldn't have been dealing with. People were talking down to me. They were like saying things like, oh, this is such a sweet little business. You know, and I had in my brain made this incredible system with a piece of technology that would really change the way things worked for artists. And it was really important to me. And I just had all these old white men telling me that it was cute or sweet, and that, you know, they're sure it will make like a great side business, that kind of thing, for 2 years. And that cut me down so badly. And our first investors after that were actually someone I worked for in private equity, a fund manager, and also a woman, a female investor. But it was, I had to go through so many people to get out on the other side of that and get like the first little bit of money so we could actually build some technology with it. And everything changed after that day, and I still deal with that kind of stuff all the time. But there are people that won't believe in you. There are people that will talk down to you a lot. There are people that will, you know, kind of laugh in your face a little. And that's hard on the soul. Like, it's hard on the soul to keep going back to that again and again and again. So you always have to like have your focus really firmly on like what your vision is and what your dream is, and make sure that's your purpose, because I don't think you can go through all that unless you feel like it's your purpose, not a passion, but like, you know, you have to, like, this is what you were put here to do in this moment, because that's kind of the only way through that. And it's really hard to find that strength. Otherwise, I think if I was just like a bit passionate, it was my side hustle, I would have thrown that out the window a long after that. There are people, you know, and then there's the other things that get hard at the beginning is learning to charge the right amount for things and getting people to actually pay you. I think probably as a freelancer, Jonathan, you probably experienced that, right? Where
definitely.
Yeah. People don't pay you. People don't take you seriously. And that stuff hurts when, you know, like I said, when it's your rent on the line, you know, it's like, damn, my landlord is gonna, I'm gonna have to take his call at some point, you know? So, it's, you know, those things are day-to-day hard, but yeah, I think it's mostly the non-believers and the people that kind of don't see what you see, and like to tell you that. And there's a lot of them when you're on the way up, loads, so many.
Was there a moment that you felt that it changed? Would you say that there's a specific moment?
Yeah, we're like nearly 5.5 years, maybe a bit more, into running this company, and it changed for me maybe about 3 months ago.
Oh, wow.
So there was a moment where I kind of crossed over something whereby I was able to talk about what we were doing so well and so effectively, and with so much of the right knowledge and education about where everyone else was coming from as well, that I think finally I started getting taken seriously. And so it's the music industry. So you have to earn your stripes. You know, you have to do enough. You have to be enough. You have to prove everything that you're doing, and you have to stand up and talk about it as well. But I couldn't talk about it well, even though we were doing good work. I couldn't articulate it well enough. And I think probably about April this year, I found it all. It was almost like it was flowing through me. Like, all the knowledge had just finally met at the right place, and it was just flowing through me. So, you know, till then it did feel really difficult. I had people would doubt me, and then I would doubt myself. And about 3 months ago, it just stopped. I had zero doubts. No one can put a doubt in my head anymore. And that's the magic moment. And if you can reach that quicker than 5 years, or if I can help anyone reach that quicker than 5 years, please let me know.
There's so much like almost pressure to be seen as a visionary or someone who kind of knows exactly what they're talking about, I think, like, especially in the tech startup world. And I'm glad you found that. I'm glad you found that conviction.
I mean, I always had it. I just couldn't express it. And the thing is your idea can be the best idea in the world. But if the people on the other side don't understand, if, you know, anyone on the other side, your like little cousin doesn't get it, you're not communicating it well, and no one is going to see what you see. And until everyone can see what you see, you know, there's you're not there yet. Like, and it is time and it is education, but it's also it's having like a certainty. That certainty, like, I have not a single doubt about what we're doing anymore. Like, nothing can penetrate my like my belief in this now. I have proved it. It works. All of it. And it's not just in tech. It kind of overflows into music as well. But the music thing happened sooner. We were more legitimate there, much easier. Tech world is mean.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, congratulations, by the way, because you got named Tech Startup of the Year, right?
I did, yeah. I did.
Yeah, big ups.
See, when that started 3 months ago, how that started was actually an investor saying to me, like, you're not ready yet. And I was like, I am so ready for this. And he was like, you're not ready. He's like, come join us, like, for like one of the biggest, it's a Universal Music Group accelerator, it's very big. And I was like, ugh, I'm so above this. I was not above this. But I went and I looked at it and I went through it. And in that process, like a few weeks into that process, I suddenly realized, like, I knew how to connect every part of what I was doing in the tech and the idea to other parts of the industry we were in. And when that started coming together for me, as we started learning and meeting and talking to, I think we spoke to 200 people over those 2 months. We spent time with hundreds of mentors. It was seriously intense. And I was running the business at the same time. It was exhausting. But, you know, I came out at the end of that, like, knowing that everything we do touches on everything else and where it touches and how it affects things. And that really brought it together. I didn't expect to win Startup of the Year. I had like the worst pitch. All my tech failed. But I was so, I knew everything so well about what we were doing that the way I communicated it landed with every single like judge in that room, and there were 40 of them. So the moment has built up over this year for that one. That coincides nicely with like, I feel like, my arrival into music tech.
That is phenomenal. I'm so inspired right now. One thing I wanted to call out actually was, you mentioned like you previously worked in private equity and you had like some relationships there, and then later on in mm-hmm. your career the same people kind of helped you. And yep. it's interesting how like you've like almost unrelated fields, but you might meet someone early on in your journey and it counts being good to them on your way up, and you kind of link up later in life and you're like, hey, I remember you. Do you remember me? Do you want to help me out?
I don't think any meeting's by accident. I think they're all purposeful. And you meet people and you're like, oh, this person's not. I think I had this thing when I was younger. I was like, this isn't useful for you, but it is. Just it's not useful now. And you might be of use to them, which is even nicer if you can help instead of you being the person that's being helped. It's nice to help other people. It's much nicer to be able to help than it is to need help. So,
yeah. So true. I was actually thinking also, I suppose the good thing that is quite inspiring also is the fact that even though you knew the person, you kind of put your pride aside and was willing to ask for help. It's a really good thing.
Yeah, that moment where you let pride interfere, for me, that's kind of something that's held me back a lot. You have to ask. You have to ask everyone, and you also have to believe so much that you don't mind asking. And you have to know how to ask as well. You know, you have to wrap up any ask you make in the right packaging for who's receiving it. But yeah, like, you're so right. Like, you just got it. You have to be ready to ask. Not a lot of people are, and not a lot of people ever do. You know, it's hard to ask for help when you need it. And you'll find, actually, you know, unless you're asking for investment, everyone is really, you know, will say yes far more. than you think. Like asking for investments, little whole different kettle of fish. But generally, like favors, I am constantly like floored at the generosity of people around me, and you know they've always been there. They've always been around, and I never asked them for things. So I think there's. When you ask, you start realizing that actually, you know, there's a lot of people that care about what you're doing and care about you, or like care about the thing you're doing. And all of those are really magical kind of things to have on your side.
I think what I found, starting up, is that not only do you have your own network, but your network has networks as well. And sometimes someone can maybe get you in touch with someone that can help you also. There's actually a book that I read as well called Rejection Proof from Jia Zhang, the author, I think the name of it is it. And he also speaks on that, being specific about what it is that you want when asking. Because sometimes we may not, like you said, make it quite clear, and then out of confusion, someone might just be like, no, I'm not really, you know, wanting to get involved. So I think that's a good point.
I'm going to get that book.
Yeah, me too. I'm loving these book recommendations. Like, I wanted to actually, like, this is something that I've kind of experienced, and like, I think we're all kind of from underrepresented groups. And I feel like almost the higher you go in your career, the more you notice the cracks, the more you notice where like opportunities are given to others, or you're kind of held back by your skin color. Or I think actually this is something, Jonathan, we spoke about before, was like when you're interviewing for a role, or you tend to communicate, like especially kind of South Asian, like Black community members, we tend to use we a lot more. And this is kind of an interesting to call out, because if you're interviewing for a role and every question that you answer is kind of starting with we, and like, oh, we did this project and we kind of did this all together, you're thinking a lot more communally, like you're thinking as a team player almost, but none of the spotlight gets put on you. People can't work out what your contribution was. I'd be interested in kind of hearing barriers like you've faced or kind of experienced, Jonathan and Tersha. I mean, you kind of mentioned some before, but it'd be cool to dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, so even I've always kind of wanted to get into graphic design and just the creative industry itself, and it was really difficult when I first started. And I think coming out of, you know, Small Green Shoots and doing so, I've built my confidence. I'm able to kind of communicate what my thoughts and be confident that I'm able to head projects and things of that nature. And I think maybe that's what gave me the confidence to even want to take the next step into freelance and go on to do much. So I think that's really important. Even then, in like when building kind of like a clothing brand and stuff, you may easily sometimes become like put into a box just because of maybe, you know, the style of the clothing or even the color of your skin. And so it's important to almost kind of break those barriers also. Like Tersha mentioned, there's going to be times when, especially, you know, whether that be your gender, your sexuality, or the color of your skin, that you will be receive some knockbacks, but kind of let that, allow that to drive you. And I think that's really important, definitely.
That's a super positive spin on it. I do, as I have made my way up, I think in the beginning I was a lot more skeptical that it existed. The more I've gotten further to the top, the more I've seen that it just looks very much the same, and like nothing like the talent or the people at the bottom or the people on the way up, which is good news for how it's going to look in the future. But, you know, we've got a lot of things to fight through before we get out on the other side. And it is a fight, I think, as well. Just the underrepresentation at the top messes with the representation all the way through, and it means you're on a longer journey and a harder journey. And yeah, you got to be resilient and tough and motivated and out there to like prove something. Not that it's like fair. It's definitely not fair, but it's like, you know, this is where the stoicism comes in.
Yeah.
yeah, it's tough. I do see it more and more the higher up I get. Like, I find that, you know, it's just, you know, I'm like the only woman on like a panel, or like, I literally, you know, my co-founder is mixed race, and I'm like, no one, like, wherever we go together, that doesn't add up at all. Like, we're always sat next to, you know, two Oxford graduates that look how you think they're going to look. And, you know, we're just like, what? Like, where is
this real?
It feels strange. The higher up you go, it's more noticeable, but I'm really hopeful for like what comes after us, and what's, because everything from where we are and underneath is like, looks so different. And, you know, everyone is fighting hard for this stuff, but it's a longer fight for it, but we have to do it now for how it looks afterwards. Like, this is our job in our time, unfortunately. And it's an inch by inch process, and everyone needs to support everyone. I think this last year has been a year of reckoning for everyone. And I'm, you know, as traumatic as it is, it was an absolute necessity to change, to like force change along and give it more momentum.
Yeah. It feels like COVID has been like the wake up call for society, and like it's kind of this big mirror that everyone has to reflect into, and not just look at themselves but look collectively at society. But it's encouraging to hear that, like, from your viewpoint, Tertia, like, things feel like they're changing, because I have that sense, but not the visibility yet.
I mean, you know, there's places I go where it's not. There's definitely that. I mean, you know, I often find myself in rooms where I'm just like, how is this relating to the music industry? It absolutely makes no sense. Or, you know, even creative industries at some point. But it is changing. I can see it from, like, we deal with a lot of artist managers and record labels, and everything's starting to look different now. And that makes me, like, feel happier or more comfortable where I am.
Actually, at Small Green Shoots, we had a fundraiser. I think you attended, didn't it?
Yeah,
Entitled And Still They Matter, where many record executives and things of that nature attended. And it was really speaking on what you mentioned, really, that the future really needs to involve underrepresented people. And that is something that we at Small Green Shoots hope to change. And so hopefully if the fight continues, but like you said, it'll be a positive thing.
Yeah. No, it's I think getting the work done, like actually knowing that, okay, cool, like it's unfair, but this is my job in my life to pull this much forward. And like, and that is, I think, if we all go through doing that, and I think we'll find a world in business, in life, you know, in the creative industries that looks a little bit more like we do, or a lot like, or just like.
or a perfect reflection.
Mm-hmm.
But Small Green Shoots is like, they do amazing work. Like, if you're listening and you haven't heard of them, like, just go check them out. And also, like, specifically for Black people, Power Up is an initiative by PRS for young entrepreneurs. And that's, yeah, just like amazing, amazing opportunity. And like, they have mentors, and kind of it's a really good step up. So recommend checking that out as well. We're almost at time, and I wanted to, we've covered a lot of kind of advice and wisdom, I'd say, and I'm grateful to have been able to facilitate that. But is there any kind of specific advice that really, really resonated with you and kind of helped you in your journey so far?
You know what, it changes. It changes week to week. How about I tell you what's getting me through this week?
Yeah, that sounds good.
This week, I've got it on post-its everywhere.
Oh, wow.
I've stuck them up everywhere to remind me, because I've had some rough times the last 2 weeks. I was like, yesterday is done. There is no worry there. So I've been, you can really beat yourself up about your mistakes, and you can really beat yourself up about missed opportunities or not getting something exactly right. And once it's over, it's over. There's nothing you can do to change it, so there's no worry in it. You have to focus on the now. So that's where I'm at this week. That's super honest.
I feel you. I feel you.
That's, I honestly have these posted. They're like everywhere. I've like stuck them everywhere I go because I'm like, yesterday is done. There is no worry there, because I've been beating myself up about small little things I could have done better, when that's all, that's the best I had to give in that moment. And I couldn't have done better. Like, I could have done better on another day, an hour later, 10 minutes earlier. But in that moment, I gave all I could give, and, you know, I can't be upset about those things. And I think, yeah, that's where I'm at this week. How about you, Jonathan? What have you got for us?
I would say never stop learning. I think, like you said, with all mistakes, there's a lesson from it. To take your business or your company to the next step, you will have to learn how to do so also. And that is something I feel like is just continuous, isn't it? Learning. Especially finding out now that you read Ego is the Enemy for the 9th time.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. You know, there's still new things
never
in
stop.
There.
I think that's amazing. And I think that's advice for life, not just for business, like to always be learning and curious. I'm with you. I'm so with you on that one. That's much better advice than my like stop eating yourself.
It's no competition. Settle down.
Yeah, I but this is advice I'm taking now. So that's it's now more value. Yeah, yeah, it's now more valuable to
me. Both of those pieces of advice are really good. Like with stuff that you think you could have done better. And it's done. It's done. There's nothing you can do to change that. It's so easy for it to just go over and over in your head. And you have to learn to let it go. Like it's a process to learn that. And similarly with like never stopping to learn, you have to really make a conscious effort to have that mindset every day. Like some days you might just need a break, and that's fine. But you have to kind of, over a long span of time, have that kind of childlike curiosity, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially this week, seeing all these billionaires go to space.
In the 500 doing? Million yachts.
What are they doing? What could we do with that? Imagine all the good. he just needed a little therapy. He didn't need to go to space.
Right? That's his vacation. Madness.
Good grief. I mean, it's just a divorce. He's not the first guy.
Just throw a space tantrum.
I need some space to a new level.
Oh my god, yeah. But yeah, thank you again today, and take care.